And of course, Gerald Clark with us as we talk about his work with the Anunnaki of Nibiru. We'll take your calls, too, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Gerald Clark with us. Gerald, do you see anything on the horizon that could be just catastrophic for us? Do they predict the future?
Well, like I said, with the zodiacal house changes, one has to consider that Anu had two sons, Enlil and Enki. One represented creation and one represented destruction.
Yeah.
Now, in the big scheme of things, creation and destruction happen at the same time and they have to be in balance. So imagine having a kid that's a creator, one that's a destroyer. Well, that's what's going on. The one who's the creator, his offspring are taking over the council, the head of the New Atlantis, right here in the United States. But before that happens, there's going to be 7 years of cleanup before the New World Order is rolled out. And that's what you're seeing right before your very eyes.
Are we going to win?
The forces of Enki do win, and the forces of Enlil get judged according to the Lost Book of Enoch, and their energy gets recycled.
Is this tied into the Book of Revelation?
Absolutely it is. That's the Christian version of very much the same thing that was said in the Lost Book of Enoch about the end of days and the judgment to come. And Enlil is judging his people right now.
Let's take some calls here for you. This hour's going to fly by. We go to Josh in Austin, Texas. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Thank you, Josh.
I was wondering, gentlemen, what do you think of the theory of Noah's Ark potentially being, a storage vault for DNA of animals instead of actually storing animals, you know, physically on board? I was also going to ask if your guest thought Noah was Anunnaki or something, but George, you took that question right out of my mouth. So,
okay, go ahead, George.
Would you like me to feel about George?
Yes, sir. He's talking to you.
recap the question for me one more time, real quick. I had a little bit of an echo in my phone.
Well, he was talking a little bit about
Noah, whether he
Noah,
was...
and I think we've answered that. But why don't you just paraphrase that again?
Okay, I'll just do it real quick. In these Sumerian accounts, Batanish was lured to the Shurupak city. Enki impregnated her. She had Noah, who was Atrahasis. He's all called Zeusudra in the Sumerian accounts. He actually was the king of Shurupak. After 600 years of the primitive man worker program with breeding, in the Atrahasis account, that's where Enlil started asserting himself, trying to wipe out humans. In the same account in the Bible, canonical Bible, Noah was the king of Shurupak. After 600 years, that's when the flood occurred, if you read in Genesis account. So they were coincident, and they do corroborate well. So he was 50% Anunnaki because the mitochondrial DNA didn't get passed to him. Enki was his father, and the woman, Batanash, was a human, a primitive worker. But on the Mount Ararat account, in the Atrahasis, it's tablet of 11, where Enlil, while the flood is overtaking the humans, they look down and see that somebody got away. And Enlil's furious. And he declares, "We, the great Anunna, swore an oath that no life was to survive this flood." And they land there, and it turns out that it's Zeusudra, who was called Utnapishtim. He got renamed by Enlil on site because of probably his guilt for what he did. And this is very, very vivid Sumerian details about what happened on that account. And it looks like that Atrahasis, who is Zeusudra, got access to the plant of longevity that the Niburians were controlling. And so even though he was 50% DNA, a Niburian, he actually got eternal life.
Would you want eternal life, Gerald?
It depends on whether I had responsibilities with it or not. would I, knowing what I know now? I think I would want a long lifetime to at least make the changes, knowing what I know, in the world so that we weren't living in such a fallen
state. I'd want a long life only if I could make, you know, an impact and change
things.
That's
right. I'd want to be able to.
I wouldn't want to go through this same thing.
No, I wouldn't want to be in a fallen state, suffering, genetically dumbed down, being, you know, suppressed in our consciousness from every kind of chemical, every kind of electromagnetic signal they can throw at us. It's the idea of the evolution of consciousness was the key central point all through my book, from the very time that the Gigi mutinied to the time that Enlil kept time after time preventing them from having access to anything that gave them higher consciousness.
All right, next up we go to Vicki in Racine, Wisconsin, first-time caller. Hi, Vicki, good morning.
Hi.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I was wondering, I know you mentioned God, but where was Jesus? What happened to Jesus? I mean, was he just kind of, and I don't want to get in bad saying this, but was he just kind of a fairy tale during all of this?
No, I don't think, I think the Anunnaki were long gone by the time Jesus came on the scene, Gerald.
Well, I've kind of got a different view of that. You realize that Enlil had taken over Rome, and through Constantine had subverted the Christian religion into this thing that they did. It was nothing like that until Constantine got a hold of it. Well, given that state, the primitive workers' consciousness were still being severely repressed by Enlil. And at that point, from the Ahura Mazda domain in Persia, recall that some magi were dispatched at Jesus' birth. You have to ask yourself why they came from Persia. Well, it's very clear that Enki had performed a ritual called the Dying Rising God Ritual that was going on in Egypt to dispense a frequency to these dumbed-down, genetically disabled primitive workers to throw them a line so they could figure out how to evolve their energy body and take on the consciousness that they were designed to have.
Next.
Enki threw him the rope through Ningxita, his son, Jesus, who was absolutely the bearer, the caduceus, the healer, and it was very, very clear. And even Edward Case corroborated that for me. It was very, very hard to pin down who Jesus was for me. That was the hardest one of all. It took me over 9 years to get good with that.
Are you sure you're right?
I'm absolutely right. I know inside and out I'm right.
That would shake things up, you know.
Yes,
that.
It will. Yes, it will. Yes, it will.
Yet he did have these mystical powers, didn't he?
Well, you read about the powers of Ningxita that were described to him by his father as he was describing to Enki. He had the powers of resurrection, of healing. He had extreme powers of energy and matter. In the Atrahasis account itself, they had a ritual where Enki had taken the energy out of one being and put it into another one. I mean, they had extreme control over energy matter, way beyond what we understand.
They must have liked this planet, Gerald. They stayed a long time.
Yeah, yeah. So I hope I answered Vicky's question about what Jesus did, what Ningxita did, this dispensation of energy that lands in the ganglion of Impar in your sacrum and becomes this kundalini energy that wakes up your quantized seven chakras is real. They gave it to us as a gift, and the fact that it's been suppressed until it came out of India to the United States just recently ought to tell you something.
How accurate do you think Zachariah Sitchin was in his work on the Anunnaki?
Well, I've read all his stuff, and I know that with that plethora of knowledge that he went after, I mean, the published works, what he did in his lifetime, is just astounding. To make a few mistakes in there, yeah, I expect that. But the reality is, in the big picture, he was right on the money. Whether, you know, this cylinder seal was a star or a sun is pretty immaterial given the physical and all the other astrological and tangible evidence that we got out of Sumer. They gave us all of the civilizations first. I think Zechariah Sitchin did more for illuminating humanity relative to the ancient astronaut theory than anyone on this planet.
Let's go to Douglas, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hello, Douglas. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Thank you, George,
sure
for
thing.
Taking my call. And, Gerald, I was wondering whether the Colburn Bible was a more accurate account of the history, or would you consider another?
Well, I really just stayed with the original source documents. I'll mention them again. Stephanie Dolly, in her World Oxford Press Myths of Mesopotamia book, put all three of these accounts in there on purpose: the Atrahasis, the Enuma Elish, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Why? It told all of our Genesis account. It told you who the players were involved and how they related to one another. There wasn't any mystery, nothing left out. If you did nothing but read the Atrahasis, all 11, 12 tablets of it, it's there. And it's in the old Babylonian, it's in Akkadian, they have several versions of it. The cuneiform has been digitized. We have a uniform script code that you can load on your computer and have those fonts that are cuneiform text. There's not an interpretation problem anymore.
The Colburn Bible was kind of scary because it was put together by a bunch of Egyptians and Celts, and they, you know, they talked about very prophetic warnings of the future. And, you know, yet to happen, but who knows? It could be.
Well, I think they were coincident with what we saw in Revelations and also what we saw in the Lost Book of Enoch, which, by the way, Enoch was Thoth, So we have a good tie-in with
They do talk about Armageddon, which is interesting that so many cultures all talk about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Well, as mentioned, it seems to me that the Anunnaki were rolling out civilization to mankind iteratively. And at some point in the past, the Ajiji broke off and were rolling out things that they were not supposed to give to humanity. Weapons making, messing with DNA. Apparently they perverted a lot of animal DNA as well. So they made a mess, basically.
We've got Ina now in Baytown, Texas. Welcome to the show, Ina. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Howdy.
Y'all just barely touched on the electromagnetic field if we were able to go wireless in our homes. And he was just about to go into how that would affect humans. And then y'all got off on something else. Could he go into that a little more? Because all the cell towers and everything they're putting up seems to affect. I have, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So many cases of cancers now and everything. Could you go into that just a little more?
All this bombardment has got to affect us.
Yeah, actually, I spend a chapter on energy and matter and what frequencies interact with us. Think about yourself as mostly water. We know if you put water in a microwave, you can hit it with 2.4 gigahertz and it'll start getting hot. So certain frequencies interact with matter and certain ones just pass right through it. So if you look at the ones that where there is an interaction and then there's a law of conservation of energy that has to take place there, then you can account for where all that energy goes. So if you got energy being absorbed in a human, that can be measured. What we do know about electricity and magnetism is that the magnetic field, in some cases, is being touted by people as a healing mechanism. And other people are saying it's causing brain damage, having your cell phone too close to your head. There's plenty of scientific evidence to show that if you have a high enough radiating antenna and it's impacting, and there's a law of conservation of energy thing going on where you're absorbing some of it, which can be measured, then there could be damage.
Oh, it's bound to affect people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if we're getting bombarded with all this and even newer technology, then if they go wireless all over the place, it could have a detrimental effect on people.
Right. And the most detrimental effect is what it's having on your brain waves, because your brain only operates from 0 to 20 hertz. So if you've got a low-frequency source that's operating at 0 to 20 hertz and you're close enough where its amplitude is higher than your brain wave amplitude, guess what? You're going to get jammed.
Let's go next to Hugh in Grants Pass, Oregon. Welcome to the show. You're in the world of smoke out there, Hugh, aren't you?
Yeah, a lot of smoke, George, and it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask this gentleman if he ever had school in Michigan. I used to teach electronics, a pilot program to elementary kids. Did he ever have electronics in Warren, Michigan?
I know Warren well. How about you, Gerald?
No, I haven't. I went to Michigan one time, and I didn't. I wasn't exposed to any electronics there. All the electronics that I've been exposed to were either here in San Diego or while I was working at Loral in Sarasota, Florida.
Why'd you ask that, Hugh? Tell me. I'm curious.
Yeah, I had dinner with Mr. Sitchin. I had a band.
Oh, you did?
Called The Bottom Line back in the 60s and 70s, and I was playing at a place called Club Tarot at 14 Mile. And John R., I believe, of Madison Heights. And after our performance, Mr. Sitchin grabbed me off the stage, took me across the street, had dinner with me, and he was shouting, Ebla, Ebla, E-B-L-A. And he had just found some tablets. And he had wanted me to announce to the world that he found something that would change the world. But he could barely speak English at that point. And I wasn't a radio announcer. I was just a performer in a lounge.
Yeah. That was
in
his beginning. That, well, you know, he ultimately did it, and he did it on his own. Gerald, thanks for the call, Hugh. I miss him. 90 years old when he died.
Yeah, I was listening to an archive of the Coast to Coast show where he was being interviewed at one point, and he stated at one point that he just wanted to know if somebody out there was going to do some DNA studies on these demigods or the full-blown Anunnaki that were here to corroborate his theory. He just wanted that done before he died. And you know, when I saw that we had found the Gilgamesh's grave, that Saddam Hussein used a German team with magnetometers to find, I was like, wow, we're real close. They're going to release that, and then we can start talking about the inactivated DNA and so on and so forth.
Saddam Hussein was into this, wasn't he?
He was big time. He thought he was the
Nebuchadnezzar.
According to sources, he thought he was a reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar.
Yep.
And he was looking for something very specific in the city of Uruk, according to Dr. David Sala, which I agree with. And that was the portal that, let's see.
Do you think he ever found anything?
Well, I believe he did. They actually reported in this press release that they had the entire structure of the city mapped out, and they found his grave. So it's in my book. I put the press release in there so that people could see it. And this was in 2003. So I was hoping that somebody would have gotten the grave and done the DNA study so that Sitchin could have been vindicated in his theories. And I believe that it's already been done. He just didn't get to know it.
But truly the cradle of civilization, wasn't it?
Absolutely. According to Noah Kramer, who's a premier sumerologist, 39 of our civilizations first came from Sumer. Law codes, zodiac, mathematics. Every instance of high civilization came out of there, and it happened overnight. It's been an anthropologist anomaly since they discovered Sumer.
It's a dream. Let's go to Edward in Santa Clara, California. Edward, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Hey, yes. Ishit Kohari, 18-year-old student, came in second place out of 1,600 students for the Intel Science Award. She made the supercapacitor that could charge a cell phone in 20 seconds, and she's claiming that probably in about 5 years she'll be able to charge an electric car in less than 5 minutes. And I know there's talk of graphene supercapacitors out there, and those you can just basically throw away after use. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think instead of charging, I think you're going to see a model like what's being done in Europe, where you just pull up to a station, they drop your battery out and put you a new one in that's already charged. But yeah, in terms of high-capacity charges and chemicals that hold charge, there's some very advanced things that economically don't make sense that are much better storage capacitors than lithium or lead acid.
Well, batteries of the future are going to be phenomenal.
Definitely.
Smaller, last longer.
Well, I mean, if you look at what the Chinese Academy of Science has done with the regenerative fuel cells, you know, simply putting water into it in a closed loop and occasionally having to add a little additional water for hydrogen store. So this absolutely amazing technology. And then, you know, in 10 years, we'll probably have it.
It's exciting, isn't it?
It really is. I think we'll see a lot of changes where more functional, we'll have a lot more functional society and a lot cleaner.
And we're right in the middle of all of it, aren't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the work in cymatics and anti-gravity with monatomics, all this new physics is really exciting in terms of what technology will lead to for humans.
Well, stay with us. We're going to come back with final phone calls with Gerald Clark here as we talk about his work, the Anunnaki of Nibiru, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Need to email me, george@coasttocoastam.com. On our next Coast to Coast program, John Zaffis joins us. Shadows of the Dark. Get ready for that. And we're going to come back in a moment with Gerald Clark. We'll take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Gerald Clark with us. We'll take your calls as well. Gerald, your background in engineering, did that help you with some of your research into the Anunnaki?
Well, it did, especially as it came to looking at the design constraints that would have had to happen if you were to implement energy and matter in a being. How would you control them if you gave them intelligence? So I looked at how the electromagnetic spectrum could be used by these advanced beings and to control their large populations of miners, city builders. I mean, consider the problem. How would you control them? So from an electromagnetic standpoint, I started looking at the features of the brain to see how this could be done. I doubt seriously they were running around these mines with Motorola headsets and taking their orders. I think it was these advanced beings and their knowledge of the electromagnetic spectrum and the fact that they had an opportunity to design us. They made it so that if we were having thoughts or doing anything that was going to lead to a mutiny, they could certainly use telemetry to snoop in on it and avert it. That would have been a primary design constraint given the fact that the Ajiji mutant in the first place.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah. And what do your colleagues say about what you do?
What do my colleagues say?
Yeah.
Relative. You mean relative to this information?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm actually finally at a place where I'm able to talk about it. There was only one person in the engineering realm that I run with here in San Diego.
He was a field
application engineer for Lattice Communications, and he would come down San Diego, and occasionally we would go to lunch, and we'd talk things other than engineering, and this would come up. But as time went on, I noticed the History Channel started exposing some of the information about the Anunnaki and the previous civilizations here. I figured that, it was starting to come out, and I sat on this information for over 9 years until I finally decided to publish it, because I knew what the ramification was. You know, if you're an ancient astronaut theory or ufologist in my particular space, probably not highly esteemed.
What do you think of Eric von Däniken?
I think he was an early pioneer. I think he asked good questions, as he stated in his book. He just asked a lot of questions, and he asked some good questions. And I think he asked the right questions.
Okay, speaking of questions, back to the phones we go. Tim is in Indianapolis, and he's up with us. Go ahead, Timmy.
Hey, I got a great show, by the way, George, longtime listener.
Thank you, Tim.
I really enjoy the guests that you have on here, no matter what the topic is. My question for your guest tonight would be, as far as markers for the Anunnaki, with blood types and O negative being a universal donor, would they have had something to do with that? Or, I mean, would, if it was just who was here, wouldn't it just be one blood type? So they had to do a lot of experimenting. And that was my question, and I'll take my answer off air. Thank you very much, George, and keep up the great work.
Okay, they have experimented a lot, haven't they?
Well, yeah, and I'll tell you, I'm not an expert on blood types, so I probably won't touch that one. But the degree of sophistication that they used in designing us is quite amazing. I mean, it's really quite amazing. So it turns out, you know, with blood types, for instance, there seems to be a propensity toward certain foods. Was that intentional? I don't know. But, there's a whole segment of the community that's looking at blood type diets now.
Go back and tell us a little bit about the Adam and Eve. What happened, and what do you think the story of the devil, Satan, the snake, how did that come about?
You like that one, don't you?
Yes, I
okay.
do.
Well, originally, in the Atrahasis account, they decided to create primitive workers by non-procreation, it was in vitro fertilization. They would do the mixing in the tube, put it into the womb of one of the Babylonian birth gods, as they started out with seven, and they weren't producing enough offspring. That's when Ningxita, Jesus, thought, I'm just going to keep saying the AKA list so people get it. That's when he interceded. He was a premier scientist with his symbol, the caduceus, and I'd love to talk about what that means at some point in the future. Maybe we don't have time tonight. He gives them the ability to procreate. They're taken back to, out of Africa, of the house of Shimti, back up to Eridu, into the Garden of Eden. Okay, this is a Sumerian word. It's E-D-I-N. Okay, we spell it Eden in the Bible. But it was there, right in Eridu, in southern Iraq. They get there. They're put into the garden to be observed. Enki and Enlil are there in the Sumerian account. And they're being monitored to see if they were successful at procreating. Okay. They're watching their primitive workers, see if they can have babies. Okay, and in that account, they apparently had the plant of life and the plant of knowledge of good and evil, and they had plenty of advanced plants in the garden in Eridu. And I was surprised they had the plant that would allow these primitive workers to enhance their consciousness. That's the key point here.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, Enlil, Jehovah, tells them, if you eat this plant, you will surely die. This is in the Genesis account, right?
Was it poison?
Well,
to them?
Well, he's just telling them, if you eat this, you're going to die, period. And then they go and do it, and all of a sudden they become sentient beings with awareness. And Enki comes on and he says, guess what? No, you won't die. You'll become aware of yourself, and you'll become gods like us. So it was always, always about the suppression of human consciousness. Enki told the truth and was demonized. Enlil lied and was promoted as the monotheistic god to the Hebrews.
I'm curious, though, about the story that ended up in Genesis, how you think that all came about, the ability to record that story.
Well, if you now take the flood account from the Sumerian documents and all the documents that were in Babylon, that was Marduk's location for all the scribes and priests were trained there for doing lingual arts, okay, the documents. Well, they were the Jewish people were being held captive, including the priests, in Babylon about 330 BC. Well, they got to see these Hebrew or these Sumerian documents and all the creation accounts. And in their attempt to placate Enlil, I'm just going to say it the way it happened, they took the plethora of creators that were on the Anunnaki Council, or the Anunnaki Council, the only two creators, is Enki and his half-sister Ninhartzog, or Isis, and they wrote an account, which became the Torah, that completely lied, monotheistized Enlil, and left everybody else out. But they messed up and didn't quite get the lingual part just right, because they messed up and forgot to turn the let us and create man in our image and our likeness and turn that into a singular form. Whoops. And there were several slips like that.
Big whoops.
Yeah. Look at the Genesis 4 and Genesis 6 count of the from Adam to Noah. How different are those? What a bunch of lies.
Let's go out to the state of Washington. Bill's out there. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Well, hey, hello.
Good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I was just wondering, this planet that the Anunnaki come from, I'd like to know something about solar radiation, temperature, atmosphere, availability of water.
What do we know of that, Mr. Clark?
Well, I didn't get a lot of that. We knew that it was four times the size of Earth.
They had to have water.
It was a brown dwarf. Clearly, they had access to water, whether they were getting it from local planets or had it on their planet, we don't know. From their account, it was in a retrograde orbit, elliptical orbit that took 3,600 years, a SAR, according to them, which all of the Sumerian kings lists were recorded in SARs, okay, which is periods of 3,600 years. When it came into close apogee with the sun, apparently, or close perigee with the sun, the solar radiation was quite intense. They were clearly bolstering their atmosphere with ionized gold. Actually, in prehistory in Nibiru, there were discussions about whether to use ionized gold or to fire nuclear weapons into the existing volcanoes to use, a more localized source to get something to shield them from the radiation. So that was going on about 450,000 years ago, according to the timeline with Sitchin and the genealogy table I put together.
But if they were like us, they had to have had a lot of water on that planet.
Well, they didn't mention much about water in the records.
Oh,
I have.
How could they without it?
I have an ancient astronaut reading list in the back of my book, which I haven't even read all of them. There's just so many documents. There's tens of thousands of them out there. But probably there are some in there that talk about the resource. Matter of fact, Enoch Thoth was taken when he was 365 years old to Nibiru, and he was taught everything about the heavens and the workings of the planets, according to the Lost Book of Enoch. Really amazing read.
Let's go to Costa Mesa, California. Gary's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Gary. Thanks for holding.
Hi, thank you for answering. I'll be brief, and then I'll explain more later if you wish. This unrealistic age of the personalities of the New Testament is explainable by realizing that they were using a calendar based on the monthly cycles of the moon rather than the annual cycles of the sun. Therefore, if you divide the 900 years or 840 years by 12, you get 70 years, which becomes realistic, and that would apply to all these time periods, I believe. If you guys have different opinions, I'd like to hear about it now or in an email later or whatever.
I'll let you react to that, Gerald.
You want me to react to that one?
Yeah.
Actually, I've considered that as well, and I looked at how they came up with their time systems. Zechariah Sitchin wrote a wonderful book on the time, the cosmic code and when time began, especially when time began. Originally, very cleverly, the Anunnaki related their Niburian time and solar and their orbit time to our Earth by our precessional wobble. That's why the zodiac and the 12th house of the zodiac and knowledge of our inclined axis and this wobble is so amazing. And then 3760 BCE, they then relegated the Nibirian calendar as a new calendar, and that was the beginning of the Jewish calendar as well. So that's when they stopped relating time from Nibiru to time on Earth. So I disagree that they were converting months into days, and that's how those times came up. Also, if you go back to the Genesis account and the ages from Adam to Noah, including Methuselah and even Enoch himself, they were hundreds and hundreds, some of them were over almost 1,000 years old. Well, that's nothing compared to the time frames shown in the Sumerian kings list. The first eight rulers themselves ruled for 241,200 years They named them. They named them in terms of SARs, and a SAR was specifically 3,600 years listed in the Atrahasis.
I don't think
there's an interpretation problem.
I find that hard to believe that the entity could live that
long. It comes down to the telomeres. Look, a red oak in Northern California will live forever unless it's destroyed by a storm.
Well, that's true.
Our DNA degrades because the telomeres at the end of our chromosomes cannot maintain their state without a proper amount of telomerase to keep them from getting degraded. That's what causes aging. Otherwise, we would live in perpetuity, just like the Anunnaki were doing.
Let's go to Joel in Blue Bell, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joel, go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm the Caduceus questioner. And could you describe differences between the deities and the things they held in their hand and what they might mean to us today?
Certainly. I'll start with the Caduceus because I think that's the most important one. This was a healer symbol of two entwined serpents around a central pole with a knob on top with lateral wings coming out of it. As Ningxia's symbol and Enki's as well, and Asclepius's, who was Orpheus, the 13th zodiacal sign, he was also a healer. What did it represent? The central pole is your nervous, is your spine. It's an electrical conduit. The top of it is a pineal gland right on the top. The serpents entwined around it represent the double helix of your DNA. And they're going upwards for a reason, because it's emanating from the ganglion and impar, which is your negative pole of your energy body. It's in the bottom of your sacrum, your coccyx bone. Okay? When the energy is released from that point, representing the entwined serpents rising up, that energy going through the quantized seven chakras of your body, or quantized consciousness levels, well, when it reaches the top, it hits the pineal gland, which then releases what's called dimethyltryptamine, and it's enclosed in your brain. Your brain produces the most powerful hallucinogen on the planet, according to Dr. Strassman, who experimented with clients to see what was going on there. And so I encourage you to read that, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, by Dr. Strassman. He was right here in San Diego, by the way.
They made us that way, didn't they?
Yeah, so this symbol, let me finish. So when that energy, this energy that animates all matter, and it's very related to gravity, by the way, when it reaches your pineal gland and releases DMT, you're on a chemical to electromagnetic conversion where you can go back and forth. So thoughts can be converted to electromagnetic spectrum and back and forth through this chemical transduction of DMT. They call it the spirit molecule for that reason. Now, once that happens, according to the Hermes teachings in the Hermetic tradition, the lateral ventricles of the brain then start to come alive, and it gives you the wings of Hermes. So all of a sudden, you've reached a consciousness level that they recognize as being the sons of God. And that's what they were teaching along the mystery schools all along the Nile. And it was headed up by none other than Ningxia himself, Thoth.
Gerald, where does Atlantis fall into any of this?
Well, Atlantis, as I mentioned in the teachings of Solon to Plato, recording the Critias, Solon was trying to find out his ancestry, and he did this by going to Sais in Egypt and meeting a priest who told him his ancestry. And that's where I found out that Poseidon, Enki, had been assigned Atlantis by his father. Okay, so now we see that there's a connection from Sumeria into Greece via Atlantis. Because they then, once Atlantis had problems and during the last ice age, clearly all the cities along the eastern Atlantic there and along the Mediterranean, where they were sunken, was due to the rising waters from the ice age and the ice melting. So his city was sunk. He moved to Greece, and his arch nemesis, Angramayu, who was Enlil, was there too, and his city was Pergamum. And if you go back to the writings in the New Testament, talking about where Antipas died and where the seat of Satan was. This is in Revelations. They clearly state it was at Pergamum, the seat of Satan. Well, the Temple of Zeus was in Pergamum, and it was moved to the city of Berlin. So, So there's the connection from Atlantis to Greece. And then, because of this concept of this new Atlantis being the United States, as recorded on the back of our $1 bill, this tells me that the founding of the United States were to be the New World Order, but it was for Enki, not Enlil. But Enlil clearly infiltrated Atlantis from his Cretan base with his pirate marauders. And so pretty much everywhere Enki went, Anvil came behind and brought wrath and destruction.
Let's go to Alex in Three Rivers, Texas. Squeeze you in here, Alex. Go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. It's great to be on. I was wondering, what do you guys think about the idea of Noah's Ark being an actual gene storage place for animals, not a place where they actually live?
Perfect. Very possible.
Listen, I'll give it to you in one answer in the Lost Book of Enki. That's clearly the case. They didn't put a bunch of animals on there. He and Ninhartzug went out all over the earth and were gathering the genetic material.
It's like a seed bank, wasn't it?
It was a seed bank, absolutely. And in addition to that, they put a Nananaki navigator on board with his son, Ziusudra, so he made sure he made it to Mount Ararat safely. And that's when Enlil and Enki had it out, because that's when Enki divulged to him on Mount Ararat to Enlil that Ziusudra was his son. That's why he saved him.
Well, now, Gerald, because you don't have a website, I'm curious, where do we get your book, The Anunnaki of Nibiru?
Well, it's on Amazon.
Okay, so you
and
made
it. It's also available on Kindle. So if you want to go in and see with tables of figures and some of the stuff I put in there, and to get a sense of it, you can see that in Kindle right now.
Well, what's your next work? I have a feeling you're not done.
Well, I actually have started three books, and one of them is going to get my full attention after this. And I'm not sure whether it's going to be with the Anunnaki or some of their infrastructure that they're rolling out as they bring on the new world.
Here's your title, The Anunnaki, They've Returned.
They never left.
Have some fun.
That's the point, is they never left.
All right, Gerald, thanks for being on the program. Great information. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.